Live from York, this is The Late Late Show with Christopher Vowles on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good evening. Tonight we will be talking about the school library, the purpose of school libraries and librarians in 2021. We'll be talking about libraries we have known and loved over the years and thinking through some of our ideas for the ideal school library. If you're a school librarian or spend much time in your school library, please call or text in via the Podbean app. We'd be delighted
Live
to hear from you.
From York, this is The Late Late Show with Christopher Vowles on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good evening and welcome. So in tonight's show, we will be discussing school libraries, that place that perhaps we haven't visited as much as we should have done over the past 12 months. We're going to be talking about the purposes of libraries and librarians in 2021. So I'd be particularly keen to hear from any of you who are listening tonight who regularly spend your time running school libraries or working in school libraries. We're going to be exploring some libraries that we've spent our time in over the years that have helped shape who we are. And we're going to be thinking about what we might put into the ideal school library if we were designing one from scratch. Up here in North Yorkshire, I've spent most of my day marking and moderating Year 11 assessments in English language and English literature, which I think is probably an experience common to many of my colleagues up and down the country. After that morning, I spent the afternoon managing javelin throwers on the college athletics field for our school sports day. As it's North Yorkshire in May, the afternoon was spent with hot water bottles, scarves, bobble hats, and copious quantities of mint tea. So after the chill of the afternoon, I was very delighted to be able to come home to put tonight's show together. The students on the field were decked out in their sports colours and their house colour face paint, waving their house flags and cheering on their housemates. For those in year 11 and 13, it provided quite a welcome break from the classroom assessments that they've been going through over the last few weeks. Although in class today, at least three students said to me that they would rather be in the library than out on a cold but sunny sports field this afternoon. So in tonight's show, I thought we would look particularly closely then at school libraries and champion school librarians, perhaps the members of the staff room that have a voice that we don't hear as much of as we ought to. So from 10 o'clock to 10:40, we'll be thinking about what libraries are for. Are they a quiet place? Are they an information centre? Are they reading sanctuaries? Do they serve a function as an archive for those schools that have been around for 100, maybe 200 years? It may well be that you're working in one of those. Do they serve as a classroom? Are they a classroom space? And if they are a classroom space, are they used as a classroom space by anybody other than the English and History departments? I'd be interested to hear your views on those points. I'll be joined shortly by Elizabeth Hutchinson to explore some of these ideas. She's got a very significant background in school libraries management, and we'll be exploring what her experience of training school librarians has been over the years. After the news, I'll be discussing libraries we have known and loved with Elizabeth, and I'll be joined by Daniel Bundred. I'd be interested to explore the question as to what part libraries have played in our education and our formation. And then in the final section of the show, Daniel and I will be designing our perfect school libraries, coming up with a list of things that we would like to see included in our perfect library. If we were to design something from scratch, what would be going on the plan? Just to remind you of the importance of libraries, Ray Bradbury, a famous science fiction writer, asked, "Without libraries, what have we? We have no past and we have no future." So my first guest tonight then is Elizabeth Hutchinson, and she has had a very distinguished career in libraries and library services. Elizabeth is a chartered librarian and fellow of KILIP. She worked for the Guernsey Schools Library Service from 2003 and was appointed head of service in 2014. She's now a trainer and advisor for school libraries, and she was awarded the British Empire Medal back in 2020 for services to libraries. She's an international speaker, blogger, and writer. She is the vice chair of the Great School Libraries campaign, which is a campaign that I think would be well worth following for those of you who are not already familiar with it. The founder of an online CPD forum for school library staff and teachers called Library Staff Love Learning. And she will be joining us shortly to discuss this first topic. My second guest tonight is Daniel Bundred, who is a familiar guest on the show. And he will be talking to me for the second part of the evening. He is a Key Stage 5 English coordinator in a South London school and a returning friend of the show. But tonight we're going to start with the news and then we will be into our first discussion. If you're listening and you happen to work in a library, please do call us or text us via the Podbean app and we will take your call. Here comes the news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. Ofsted makes its return to routine inspections this month. A statement on the GovUK website outlines that the focus of their inspections will depend on a number of factors, namely, most recent inspection judgments, information held about the provider, including any recent concerns or notifications, and the amount of time since the last inspection. Ofsted stated they believe the planned summer activity will have a positive impact, and they are looking to implement the summer inspection programme to challenge and support providers effectively. The latest schools infection survey has shown a significant drop in the number of secondary school pupils and staff testing positive for coronavirus. This data comes from schools across 14 participating local authorities and has been described as encouraging. Health experts have, however, stated it is important public health measures continue within school environments to limit infections and transmission. A report in the London Economic has worked out that the cost of the proposed royal yacht in memory of Prince Philip could cover that of 86,956,522 free school meals. With 20% of state school students now qualifying for assistance, the LE felt the money would be better spent. The Queen herself is said to be well aware of the optics and displeased with the plans for the royal yacht. What does the future of education look like to you? Teachers Talk Radio wants to hear your ideas as part of its latest competition. Simply submit a video presentation of up to 10 minutes outlining your thoughts to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. The 5 selected winners will receive a prize of £50 and the opportunity to present at a high-profile education conference. More information can be found on the Teachers Talk Radio website. That was your daily education news briefing.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Megan. And I'm pleased to say Elizabeth joins us on the line now. Good evening, Elizabeth. Good evening, Elizabeth. Can you hear me? I think we might have a problem with your line, Elizabeth. Can you try disconnecting and then reconnecting and we'll try and bring you in? Well, we can hear you now. Good evening, Elizabeth. How are you?
Hi, can you hear me? Hello.
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear.
Oh, good. Sorry, I love technical things.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a hitch there, but it's great to have you on the show tonight. So I've already introduced you to our audience. Would you like to talk us through your route into libraries work over your distinguished career?
Yeah, I was a kind of person that left school at 16, really not sure about what I wanted to do, and landed with a job in Newcastle City Libraries at 16. Would I say that it was my passion in life? I'd probably not. It was something for me to do. But I grew to learn to love it. I was a library assistant in the city library, and then became somebody that worked in the local studies department as I progressed. I then married and met my husband and married and moved to Guernsey, where I had three children, and decided that after I'd had three that it was time to get back into the work field. So there's only one library in Guernsey, and luckily at that point they were looking for a library assistant, and I thought, oh, that's my job. So turned up for that, applied, got the job, great. Realised that I was a little bit bored, hadn't, you know, felt that there was something more that I could be doing, and got the opportunity to potentially have a promotion if I, you know, waited round for the right things to happen. About 2 weeks after that, I found out I was pregnant with my fourth child. So decided that I wanted to leave and be at home with him, but really was ready to move forward with my career. And at the time, Aberystwyth University were just putting out an opportunity to do a distance learning degree online. So I was able to be at home with my fourth child while also studying for my library qualification. And when I went back when he was three, I was able to work as a professional librarian for school's library service. So it was a I found my passion as I was older, when I realized that there was a focus and a purpose to it for me. So I can't say I was somebody that was a library, you know, I had wanted to work in a library since the age of four. That's certainly not me, but as I grew older, the opportunity to do something that I was engaged with and loved became apparent, and schools libraries were my thing eventually.
Fantastic. It's a wonderful introduction. And in terms of school libraries then, what do you think they're for, Elizabeth?
Well, I think it depends on who you're speaking to. I think if you talk to most people about libraries in general, most people think that they're about reading for pleasure. They're about encouraging people to read. Literacy levels are high if you've got a library. But I think that like school libraries of today, there's more, and it's a lot of it that is misunderstood and not understood enough. So a school library for me is something that is there for cross-curricular. It's the opportunity to provide obviously resources and content that is educational and at the right level for students. But it's also something that is a place where, with a school librarian, you could teach skills. You know, we talk about a lot about the fact that, you know, students of today don't aren't able to spot fake news. They're ready to take clickbait. Or, you know, all of these kind of things. And with the right person in place within a school library, there's the expertise of the research and the information skills that you get from a school librarian, and you know, that expert there is something that is, you know, right across the school. So there's a bigger thing than just a library with its books and its, you know, as much as that's all lovely, there is so much more to it.
So the librarian sits at the heart of the library, and it's, I think it's the Neil Gaiman quotation that is particularly instructive in what a librarian can offer. Google can bring you back 100,000 answers, but a librarian can bring you back the right one. Is there a sense that schools are making the best use of their librarians, do you think?
No, they're not. But I want to go back to that Neil Gaiman quote. And I would say that as much as that's a great quote, I think the librarian can help you find the right answer. It's no longer about the librarian being behind that desk, you know, when you go and ask them the question, providing you with the answer. It's now that skill to provide you with the to provide you with the opportunity to find the answer for yourself. And actually, that is where we need our students to be. So going back to the question about school librarians being misunderstood, is that the word you used?
Misutilized, I think, or underutilized.
That's a much better word. Underutilized. I think what it is that there's a lack of understanding of what school librarians can do. I think it's about if I think about the young teachers of today. So as an example, I've got two sons who are teachers, and you know, they went through school at the time when the internet was very new to education, and it was all exciting, and there was a real dip in the use of school libraries, particularly because why would you need a school library when you could go home and click on the internet and get the answer? Luckily for my sons, they were still told that they had to look at that Encyclopedia Britannica for their answers before they were allowed to click. So that generation of children then went through school without school library, you know, as school libraries began to die off. And they then went through to, you know, universities. And again, there's no real clear link to teacher education and, you know, the value of a school library. We just assume that everybody thinks it's a great idea and a thing to have. So we've come almost in a full circle, because we've now got a problem with the fact that, you know, students are not able to search for quality resources easily. They don't have the skill set, and school libraries are now making a comeback because that is a needed skill, but nobody's really sure how to access it and make it happen.
Is there a question about whether it needs particular curriculum time, do you think?
So I think, personally, I think it's something that needs to be integrated within the curriculum. I work with a project called FOSSIL, which is a framework of skills for inquiry learning, and I'm a strong advocate of it. My friend and colleague, Daryl Turian, created it based on lots of research that were done previously. And it's a framework that starts in year one and goes all the way through to year 13, and it's embedded through inquiry. So it's not expecting our year 12s to suddenly be able to, you know, write an extended essay without the skill set that they would need to be able to find, evaluate, understand, interpret information. We would suggest that, you know, in any inquiry project that you have, you know, all the way through down in primary school, that you are encouraging and advocating and supporting the process of inquiry. So, you know, all the way through, there's suggestions and ideas of ways that you can actually help and support students so that they're going on a journey through the process and learning to learn for themselves, which I think is really important, that they go through the process of beginning to understand not only finding and regurgitating information, but actually being able to say, I've read that and I can now explain it and have a deeper understanding of what it is that I'm learning about, which is what the process of inquiry is all about.
And what do you think that inquiry might look like if we drop it all the way down into primary school?
It can be really, really simple. Really simple. So we're talking about, you know, students as young as, you know, 7 year olds understanding the importance of a keyword. Obviously at that stage you would be giving them the keywords, but you know, and this is where books, you know, very clearly still come into this process. Students are, you know, made to look in an index and find the keyword. They then have to find the keyword on the page. You know, it's sort of that kind of, you know, can you find, you know, the answer that we're looking for on the page? What's a good question? It's about encouraging students to ask questions for themselves. So in primary school, you would definitely have an overarching question set by the teacher, but the students themselves would be encouraged through the process to ask questions from what they're reading. You know, we're finding these days, aren't we, that students very rarely just read for any length of time. So you know, they read the, if they're reading online, they read the headline and make assumptions from what the headline is saying rather than actually reading the whole thing. And it's trying to encourage students to take that next step, that I've read something, but what does it mean to me and how does it make me feel? And actually, this is a really important part of research and investigation, is that students need to be put into the heart of it. So, you know, there's a big difference between being told to go and find out about something, but actually if you are then in the centre of it, it changes it if somebody asks how you feel about it. And a lot of students have never even thought about how they feel about something. But actually, when it's a simple question like that is asked, it changes it. So if I can give you an example, I was supporting a year four class who had been doing yearly project on India. And each year they had been finding out about the culture and the clothing and the food and everything else. And at the end of the project, you know, everything that they found was put onto a poster. And we sort of thought about how we could integrate, you know, using the library catalogue so that they could find the information themselves. But what was central to what changed within that project was the overarching question. And we came up with one, would I still be me if I was born in India?
Fantastic question.
And immediately, though, that's really, it's really clever, because immediately they begin to think about, you know, okay, I live in Guernsey, so therefore, you know, I'm going to be eating fish and chips down by the beach. Would I be eating fish and chips if I had been born in India? And it just really changed it, and there was an expectation of this year four group to come up with a conclusion. And I think we don't necessarily push our students as far as we can, because we're so focused on the information that they need to have. And it just, you know, a conversation with a librarian who can then provide not only sort of the support for that kind of thing, a great question, but also the opportunity to, you know, navigate the resources that are available from schools. So I often say, you know, schools pay a lot of money for their library management systems, and they tend to sit very clearly in the library, where they're used to issue books and to manage the collection. But actually that library management system should be sat, you know, in your classrooms, which it is. Most of them are networked or online or hosted. So, you know, you should be able to use it as a digital literacy tool that your teacher, your librarian will be able to show you and be able to, you know, find resources, so books from your library, but also maybe connected websites through your library management system. So it's about sort of taking that next step and using the resources that are available to you within school that very often just gets overlooked.
Indeed. Are there particular ways in which schools can set up their spaces, and I'm thinking of primary here particularly, to invite that kind of inquiry learning that you're suggesting is important to students' wider education?
It definitely depends on whether you've got access to a librarian or not. I think that makes a particularly, you know, makes it possible for you to be able to do something very clearly because you have somebody to manage that. If you don't, then obviously the school's library service, those that are still left, they do offer professional support, so you can contact them and they can come in and help. But it's about understanding what you have and how you can use it beyond the library. So libraries are 24/7, even in primary school, and it's making them available. So students, if there isn't a librarian in a primary school, who is it that's looking after the library management system? Who knows how that can be encouraged and used in the classroom, for example? That's why you need a librarian in there to be able to support that kind of link. I was talking to somebody just the other day about the explosion of people using students reading ebooks, and obviously they've started reading ebooks more because of lockdown and coronavirus. But prior to lockdown, lots of schools had ebooks, but they weren't being used. And it's about somebody being there to be able to go, this is a resource that's here, this is how you use it. So for example, when we brought ebooks into the school's library service, for the first couple of years the usage was rubbish. They're very expensive ebooks, so it was really important that we were there to encourage usage. Our librarians went into nearly every class in the primary schools and showed the students all how to use it, gave them a library card number so that they could access it. And you know, it skyrocketed. It went, you know, almost stratospheric. Now, usage does eventually die off because the excitement, you know, of the first time you've seen something. But actually just that reminding people that it's there, and it's like any resource. So your library management system, your ebooks, the resources that you buy. So if you buy Britannica online, if you buy Q files, if you buy whatever resource it is, if there's nobody there saying this is the resource and actually this is how you navigate and access it, then they don't get used beyond the people that currently know how to use them.
So students certainly need training in how to use these information systems. What additional training do you think teaching staff themselves, if we move on now into secondary school, might need training in?
Well, I think this is really clever because I really think that I need to tell you about something first. So the IFLA School Library Guidelines says that school librarians do 5 core activities. Literacy and reading promotion, media and information literacy instruction, inquiry-based learning models, technology integration and professional development for teachers. And the reason I wanted to share that is that because of that last one. So, you know, when we talk about professional development for teachers, as a librarian, most of us think, you know, we're going to be in your inset days and we're going to, you know, tell you about our libraries and everything else. And as much as that's a great thing to do, being in a classroom teaching the students to access the library management system is also professional development for the teacher as well. So, you know, school librarians cannot possibly be in every classroom in their school every day. It's not possible. There's one of them, possibly two of them, if the school is very lucky. But actually, the job of the school librarian is to support teachers to access the resources. And actually, if that's done via teaching a class evaluate websites, or if it's doing a digital literacy lesson using the catalogue, then that's part and parcel of that. But it's really, really important that teachers know and understand the wealth of support and resources that are available from libraries, that their school library, that they very often, it just gets overlooked, it just doesn't get thought about, or even, you know, broached. You know, I've often said to teachers that I've spoken to, when was the last time you spoke to your school librarian? Do you know what resources are in the library that are related to your subject? You know, if you're a teacher listening to this and you know, you're frustrated at the fact that your students Google the question and come back with, you know, the same answer as everybody else, then, you know, what is it that we're doing with the resources that are in our schools to make this change? And one of the things that you could definitely do is talk to your school librarian and ask them for support.
Indeed. And how is the current situation in Guernsey? Because most of our listeners perhaps won't have experience of that particular educational community.
So schools library service in Guernsey is a little bit different from the schools library services in the UK. They provide a service to all schools here in the island. The secondary schools have library assistants in them, and the librarians go in and support the primary schools. So it's a very special relationship that the schools library service has with the public library as well. So there's lots of great activities that go on. So we have a massive book week every year. So three authors are invited over to the island, and they visit every school for the week. You know, we work them hard. They're really shattered by the end of the week, but it's a great community. You know, I think that there are schools libraries. So the other thing is, it's a free service to the schools. That's something mm-hmm. that's very unusual. Most schools library services in the UK, you buy into. Good, great value, because most of the resources that you buy, the resources that you buy, get from schools library service, you know, value-wise, you couldn't buy that amount of stock. So, you know, there's real positives about buying into a school's library service if you're near one.
Thank you. And the model in Guernsey sounds a very, very powerful one. I wonder what prospect we have in the near future of something similar being deployed in England.
Oh, it would be lovely. you know, to be able to provide a librarian or give access to every school, access to a librarian would be amazing. I think I heard in your introduction that you said that I was the vice chair of the Great School Libraries campaign. We did a survey in 2019, and the outcome of that was that one in eight schools don't have access to a library or librarian. And most of those were schools in areas of deprivation.
What do you think the consequence of that would be in the medium term?
Well, the problem is that those schools that don't have school librarians or libraries generally don't have a large book collection. You know, they do their best with having book corners in their classrooms. But obviously that doesn't replace what you get when you have a school library with a librarian, you know, managing the stock. So if a child is in a school in an area of deprivation where they are unlikely to have books at home, they're unlikely to have access to the internet at home, you know, those are the children that need school libraries more than ever. And it's just really sad that actually we live in a society that you know, doesn't think that we should be putting school libraries into every school. You know, I don't know whether you know this, but apparently it's a legal obligation for a prison to have a library.
It is, yeah.
But it's not legal. You don't have to have a school library. So, yeah, that seems a bit mad to me, but
it does seem odd.
It does, yeah. So, you know, the Great School Libraries is about raising awareness and about, you know, saying that our children deserve better, that every child deserves a Great School Library. We are collecting evidence, so people are writing case studies and blogs for us. And if anybody's listening and they'd like to write a case study of, you know, what they're doing in their schools with their libraries and how it's making a difference, then all the evidence that we can collect, the better. So, you know, please search them out, Great School Libraries, on the we have a website, and come and write for us. That would be great.
Perfect. And on the issue, the sometimes vexed issue of the contest between screen and book in the school library space, does the Great Libraries Project have a view on that?
I wouldn't say they particularly have a view, but I certainly have one. I think we're very naive to think that children should not look at screens and not use the internet. And, you know, we are where we are. I think there is definitely a balance. I think our libraries are changing because of that. So I think when I first started working in libraries, you would see at least, you know, maybe 60-40, that it was non-fiction. That you know, obviously it was there, the library was there for study and the books were there to be used. I think what we find now is that it's probably swung the other way. So you've got more fiction in your libraries these days. It's difficult to keep non-fiction up to date. You know, as soon as it's published, some of it is already out of date. So, you know, there's a real balance to be had. I love physical books, and I think they should definitely be part of every student's learning journey. But I think we owe our children the duty to teach them how to search online effectively through the good quality resources that we buy and pay for, that they are then guided through. So it's a process, isn't it? So, you know, just as we teach children to read, we need to teach children how to access and read information online. And stop just expecting or thinking that they can do it because they can switch it on and they can play the most exciting game that, you know, most parents can't understand. I think we need to believe that as parents and as adults that we are not as bad online as we think we are, and actually it's about guiding them through the process. So I think, you know, long-winded way of saying, I think online is obviously here to stay, and we need to find a balance that allows students to effectively use both types of resources.
I think you're probably right. I think that seems the way the future looks. Do you get a sense of what that balance might look like as secondary students make that transition towards university, particularly with perhaps the EPQ project that many students in sixth forms might be attempting?
I think it's really interesting, actually, because when you look at why the EPQ was brought in, it was because the students were getting to university without the skills that they needed to be able to research properly. So students who have done the EPQ generally hit the ground running once they get to university because they've gone through that process. What would be lovely to see is that if that process was integrated much, much earlier. So your year sevens, you know, understanding about referencing, your year sevens understanding about evaluating websites, you know, going through that process, that fossil process, so that when they got to year 12, they were doing an absolutely fantastic extended essay. With the skill set that they needed. You know, most students arrive at university level with the first 6 months trying to work out how this all works, you know, having possibly never used a library or online resources the way that you have to once you get to university. So I think, you know, the job of the EPQ does really well, but how many students does that actually hit? Because it's not compulsory, it's not something that everybody has to do. So what do we do about those students that are going to go to university, that haven't done something like the EPQ, and are left floundering in that first 6 months because they have to work out how to navigate an online journal that they've never experienced before. Do you know, it's a very difficult one, and I think schools need to prepare students better with the support that they have within their schools, with a school librarian. Yeah,
it's interesting if you're thinking about navigating their way around the digital resources. I mean, I can recall in my first year at university trying to navigate my way around the university library physical space.
Yeah.
And I was at for quite a while at Senate House Library in central London, Bloomsbury, University of London's library, which is on multiple floors. And just the idea of going to find a book and having to take a lift to get to the next floor to find the book that you wanted was quite strange, actually, I have to say.
Yeah. I think it's just, you know, that if we could make school libraries a place of learning where students wanted to be, then that first step at university where, you know, there's always a library tour, and, you know, most students don't want to go on it because they don't think that that's a cool thing to do. But it's the ones that do are a step ahead already, because they, you know, they know where their section of stock is, that for a start, you know. I think it's a very strange thing that we've sort of got our students into the fact that, you know, they believe that they are doing great research through typing the question into Google. And actually, I think, like I was saying before, putting them into the heart of their learning through actually asking them how they feel about what they're writing, what are they understanding about what they're writing, it opens a world of opportunity. Don't they say that, you know, students, if you tell a student that they have to do something, you know, some research, it's very difficult to get everybody to be engaged. Whereas if you allow a student to investigate something that they are interested in, then it obviously makes a difference to their research. And I think we need to find a way of encouraging more of that. So even within secondary schools, there are inquiry projects going on within science and history. And if we could just turn it so that what they need to learn, they're learning. So, you know, we know that at the end of the year, they need to sit a test and, you know, they need to demonstrate their learning. But if we could engage them by allowing them to go off on a tangent within set boundaries, obviously, just it would make a difference to their learning, because they would feel as if they were in control of it. And I think,
yeah, so it's certainly about the expedition of the knowledge discovery, isn't it, there?
Yeah, and I think it just sort of makes a difference, doesn't it, to how we could change what it is that we're doing. So when I talk about sort of integrating Fossil, I'm not saying that you have to change everything that you're doing. I think what it is, it's about providing some great resources that are already made that can be edited freely. It's a freely available framework that you can then use as and how you want. And it actually opens up that conversation with the librarian that allows you to explore avenues that maybe, you know, you've taught the same topic for several years. Do you want to change it slightly? You know, inviting somebody else in, as scary as that is, into your classroom, it just might bring you something that you didn't think about or didn't know about. You know, it's about collaboration, isn't it? And it's about bringing together the teaching expertise and the information expert to provide something really special for your students.
Certainly. Apologies for the car horn sound, by the way, earlier. I don't quite know what's been going on in the quiet market town of Kirby Moorside tonight, but it seems to have blown over now. In the last 3 minutes, then, I think we might bring this conversation to an end just before the news, and then we will talk about what our library experiences have been like, perhaps, for 15, 20 minutes after the news. So just before we go to the news, Elizabeth, could you suggest to our listeners then three things that schools ought to be doing if they want to run an efficient and effective library service?
Okay, number one, if you haven't already employed a professionally qualified librarian, then do so. If you have a librarian in your school, then as a senior leader, it is important that you understand what your school librarian can do, and to encourage and engage all your teachers to be using the library and the librarian in some way. And thirdly, if you're a teacher, walk down that corridor, open the library door and speak to the librarian and say hello and find out what they can do for you.
Perfect, thank you. That's a good way to end this first discussion. Are you happy to stay with us after the news, Elizabeth?
Absolutely, I will stay.
Perfect. I'm going to go to the news, and then after the news, I'll be bringing Daniel in to join us in the conversation.
Great.
So here is the news with Megan.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. Ofsted makes its return to routine inspections this month. A statement on the GovUK website outlines that the focus of their inspections will depend on a number of factors, namely, most recent inspection judgments, information held about the provider, including any recent concerns or notifications, and the amount of time since the last inspection. Ofsted stated they believe the planned summer activity will have a positive impact, and they are looking to implement the summer inspection programme to challenge and support providers effectively. The latest school's infection survey has shown a significant drop in the number of secondary school pupils and staff testing positive for coronavirus. This data comes from schools across 14 participating local authorities and has been described as encouraging. Health experts have, however, stated it is important public health measures continue within school environments to limit infections and transmission. A report in the London Economic has worked out that the cost of the proposed royal yacht in memory of Prince Philip could cover that of 86,956,522 free school meals. With 20% of state school students now qualifying for assistance, the LE felt the money would be better spent. The Queen herself is said to be well aware of the optics and displeased with the plans for the royal yacht. What does the future of education look like to you? Teachers Talk Radio wants to hear your ideas as part of its latest competition. Simply submit a video presentation of up to 10 minutes outlining your thoughts to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. The 5 selected winners will receive a prize of £50 and the opportunity to present at a high-profile education conference. More information can be found on the Teachers Talk Radio website. That was your daily education news briefing.
So welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Elizabeth Hutchinson talking school libraries, and Daniel Bundred is about to join us too, so we will have him come in and join our conversation very, very shortly.
Can you hear
me? And I think Daniel is on the line now. Good evening, Daniel. How are you?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. Perfect.
Ian, I'm very well, thank you. I spent an inordinate amount marking Year 11 language tag. So this makes a nice change.
Certainly does make a good change to be talking about libraries. So, Elizabeth, I wonder if you might tell us then whether you have had any particularly memorable library experiences, either in buildings you've known or loved, or in the course of your experience of training and visiting other library staff in different libraries across the country.
Well, when I knew I was going to answer this question, it's very difficult because there's so many lovely libraries around the world, aren't there? I can't say that I have visited all of them. It is on my bucket list. I'm sure that there's a list out there of beautiful libraries to visit. And once I retire, that's certainly something that I will be endeavouring to do. One of the memorable libraries on a trip once was the Trinity Library in Dublin. Beautiful, beautiful place. I just wished I could have you know, had it to myself rather than the hordes of tourists that I was in the library with. It sort of spoilt it slightly. But as far as libraries that are memorable, I have to mention my own little public library in Jesmond that was about a 25-minute walk away from home. It was the place that I was probably one of the first places that I was allowed to go to as a child on my own, to be able to walk in and choose whatever I wanted to read with the support of the librarian that was there. You know, when you asked me earlier about where did my library journey start, I think my love of reading probably started at Jesmond Library. It was a very safe and lovely place. The other library that I truly remember is my secondary school library, which was a place that I felt it was a safe haven. I wasn't a cool kid, and I wasn't particularly bullied, but I was on the outskirts of everything. So to be able to go and sit in my school library and feel safe, and I think that's what we don't necessarily always think about our school libraries, is that they're a safe haven for students who need somewhere to go. And that was certainly something for me, and it was important. I was allowed to read whatever it was that I wanted to read. So it's that kind of thing for me is about the place itself and you know, part of my life's journey, I suppose, through libraries is what's most memorable for me.
Thank you. It's a very nice answer indeed. I did have down here on my list of notes, libraries as sanctuaries. And I think I've certainly had that experience myself as a reader over the years. Daniel, are you still with us? It looks like your connection might be a bit temperamental. But have you had any particularly memorable experiences in libraries over the years?
I don't think I've had any striking experiences. I do very much remember the library on the public library run by Islington in the late 90s as being that I had an awful lot of in terms of it's quite a small child, its size and possibility. The internet was still in terms of its presence in home. Beyond that, as an undergrad of a different university, finding a book where the nearest out on interlibrary loan was Bodleian, and the Bodleian offering me a desk there while I was on a research project, which I'm hugely appreciative of. Sense of being in that space and having that entitlement. And I think, and this is getting into adult of libraries, we also spoke one day about the British Library and the time spent in a British Library reading room. And to a sort of extent, I know we talked about the overcrowding.
I'm sorry, Daniel, your line is breaking up a bit. We can't hear you particularly clearly at the moment. Is it possible for you to try and reconnect, perhaps?
Yes, I can.
And we'll give it a go. We picked up the British Library there from Daniel's suggestion, and I've been fortunate enough to spend quite a number of days and essentially the best part of 4 years working in the British Library space. An absolutely, absolutely wonderful building, a building purpose-built from what I could see, for the experience of learning in a comfortable space. As a postgraduate student, I would be there from about 8:30 in the morning on a Monday to about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, Monday to Friday, the occasional Saturday, while I was doing my research into little magazines, which were only actually held there and at UCL's Special Collections Library. So it's definitely a place that's very dear to my heart, although it's become significantly busier, the London Reading Room, since I finished my study. I also get to use the Boston Spa Reading Room up here in North Yorkshire too, about 40-minute drive from the house. And that's very, very strange. It's like visiting a nuclear power facility or some kind of weapons plant. You drive into an industrial compound past one of those barrier guards where they ask you why you're there, and then you drive through this kind of strange, almost sci-fi landscape until you find a series of essentially prefab buildings which have been kitted out very, very elegantly inside. It's a wonderful place.
It sounds very, very similar to, we have an archive building here in Guernsey, and it's built within an old church. So the outside looks like a church. When you go into it, there is a metal box that is all obviously climatized and to keep their storage, their records safe. And you know, they do tours of this place. It's almost like going into a second world within a building. It's almost like going into a TARDIS, I suppose. You know, the fact that you're going into something that looks completely different on the outside to suddenly being something really, really different on the inside. These places can be absolutely fascinating, can't they?
Yeah, it's almost a case of never judge a library by its cover.
Absolutely. I think. Hidden within.
Let's try and see if we can get Daniel back with us. Daniel, are you there?
Yes.
Oh dear.
I think Daniel's connection is still proving problematic. So perhaps we'll try and get Daniel back a bit later on in the discussion. But yeah, it's interesting you bring up Trinity College Dublin, which is where I spent part of my postgraduate years. And you get the very clear contrast between that kind of wonderful, traditional 18th century style Great Hall,
yeah,
and the visitor centre for the Book of Kells, and then the much, much more functional brutalist concrete building of the Berkeley Library, which is where most of the students spend much of their time working from their books. So I can certainly relate to those experiences.
And it's funny because I worked at Newcastle City Library, and that has subsequently been knocked down and rebuilt. So when I was working in it, it was known affectionately as the Radiator. It was a concrete building that had concrete circles around it. It was a very, you know, it didn't look particularly nice on the outside. But I worked, like I said, in the local studies department, and you would go through, so you couldn't access any of the resources without filling in a form and somebody going getting it for you. And I would regularly have to bring out large volumes of newspapers. So back in the day, this is showing my age, they weren't on microfilm, or you know, they hadn't been digitized. So it would be a case of, you know, a massive book that had a year's worth of newspapers in it being lifted from the floor or slid onto a trolley and rolled out to the person that was asking for it, you know. And it was always a dreaded moment when they looked at it and they went, oh, it's not in that one, it might be in the next one. And you would have to go back through into the stacks to try and find the next volume for them, you know. So it was a very physical job back in the day.
The stacks are always a mysterious place. What goes on there?
Well, that would be telling. a lot of it is, well, it depends which library you're in. So some libraries actually have stacks that move, rolling stacks. So, you know, they're very technical these days, the newer ones, but the old ones that, you know, you're winding a handle that rolls your shelf along. We used to do the Gilorlay Library, which is the public library in Guernsey, they have a rolling stack. And we would do tours of the library to show students, you know, take them into the little nooks and crannies that you're not allowed to go to normally. And we would show them the rolling stacks, and they just couldn't believe that you could roll 10 shelves along out of the way with one hand, you know, because of this mechanism that it is. It's, you know, looked like we were very strong, but we weren't. But yeah, you know, stacks are there to sort of keep the things that sometimes it's you need them locked behind doors so that they, you know, they're not stolen or taken. Sometimes it's because you need an overflow so that, you know, you've got to have, you're not ready to get rid of something, so it has to go somewhere. It just depends on what type of library you have as to what you find in your stacks, I suppose.
Yeah, my experience of the rolling shelves takes me back to the poetry library at the South Bank Centre, where they have a whole room essentially of rolling shelves all the way along the space so that they can fit all of their little poetry magazines into that space. I spent a fair few hours in that library over the years too, reading all kinds of strange things.
I was always very worried that I would be in a stack that was opened and somebody else would roll it closed, you know. Luckily that never happened, and it never happened to anybody that I knew. There's obviously some kind of mechanism that doesn't allow a stack to close on you, but yes, I'm sure that would make a great mystery story.
Certainly, you need to choose your visit time carefully. Yes. We've got a few texts coming in from listeners. We've got Manu here, who says he has particular issues in school libraries in Egypt with students not perhaps spending enough time in them. Children not being made to or given the opportunity to experience these spaces.
Absolutely. I think personally time is what students are not given. So they're not given time to read. The number of times that I've been in a classroom where students were, you know, they found a book or they found an online resource, and without having read anything, they've already got their pens in their hands and they're writing something down. And I've, you know, often wondered why we don't say, right, we're not going to write anything for the next 10 minutes, just read what you found. But I think that rushed element of today's, you know, schooling, today's society, is that there isn't time. But I think we definitely need to try and find time for our students and actually give them that, you know, I've watched primary schools where they're given, you know, 5 minutes to get into the library to change their book. How can anybody make a decision in 5 minutes? Literally, the children are rushing in, they're throwing their book back, and then they're grabbing the first one that they can find, you know. So yeah, it would be great if we could find more time in schools to allow students to navigate the library more. Yeah, just find themselves in the library.
Brilliant. I'm going to give Daniel another try, I think. See if he can hear us. Daniel, can you hear us now?
I've been able to hear you. The question is, have you been able to hear me?
We can hear you a little bit better now than we could earlier.
Okay.
Have you had any thoughts on what we've been talking about?
I've largely been to solve this technical issue. I do agree that library time feels limited. I think a lot of British secondary schools have in Key Stage 3 library lessons, which time is an hour is allocated once a week or once every 2 weeks for students access the library, and then C starts, and we haven't quite inculcated that hour is something to take out of their own time as well. Library usage seems to drop off sort of precipitously after year 8 or year 9.
And why do you think that might be?
I think there's a question about whole school reading and about ensuring that pitch like for the younger years continues to be sustained. Because as you said, something we all then pick up again as undergraduates. But there's this big sort of grey area, this void of Key Stage 4, quite a lot of Key Stage 5. The library is barely being used at all. I certainly don't know how it is that we'd solve something that, you know, is a query to be to full-time school librarians.
You see, I think that's a really interesting thing. I've been recently running a training course called Reading for Learning. And in my research to be able to provide that training, I was looking at what is it that makes students drop off at, you know, the end of year 8 and and effectively seem to stop reading. And what I found was that actually you're going to have that core student that has always loved reading, that reads loads, and they will continue to do so. You'll have those students that really struggle to read, and yeah, it doesn't matter what you're going to do, it's still going to they're going to have a difficulty throughout, and obviously as they get into year 8 and year 9, it's even harder to encourage them. But then there's that group of students who should really be continuing to read, and they don't, or they don't seem to. And I think really what's happened is that their focus on what they're reading changes in year 9. They get busier at school. They do lots of reading for research, for you know, the things that they need to read for their homework. They're reading lots of stuff online. So I think actually our focus on worrying about them not reading enough fiction should change slightly. And actually, I'm not saying we shouldn't encourage them to read fiction, we should. But actually, if we are focusing on what they are reading and what they are getting out of it, then we can engage and support them more. So it's about that, the different vocabulary that they're getting. So if they're only reading fiction, they're not getting the vocabulary that they need for GCSE science, for example. So they need the non-fiction texts to encourage that vocabulary. So it's almost a good shift in some ways that we shouldn't get too hung up on, but actually allow them to investigate the things that they are reading. Does that make sense? I don't know whether it does.
Makes sense. Earlier on in the show, though, you mentioned there's a shift in school libraries towards fiction, away from non-fiction. Whether there's a question sort of to be discussed in terms of library design, about whether it seems sensible to zone spaces in libraries that are predominantly key stage five, in which that non-fiction wider reading around the courses studying can be engaged in, a sort of sense that the orientated school libraries are feeling a little babyish for them.
Potentially, I think the reason that libraries expand into fiction is because their non-fiction stock's not being used. But I think if we were to re-engage students with the right non-fiction and with the right encouragement and support, then zoning a library so that you have very clearly your sixth form, you know, subjects. I'm not an advocate for splitting things up too much, but I think there is definitely an element of like you say, engaging those older students in the texts and the resources that they actually need. And I think you could really excite some students about the fact that there are resources there that are for them and their particular subjects. I think that would be quite an exciting thing to do, actually. But it's about money, I think, at the end of the day as well, is that where do you spend your budget, your library budget on? If a teacher, to be honest with you, if a teacher was engaging with me and I, you know, he or she was a science teacher and their science resources were poor, then I would be having a conversation with the science teacher about what resources, what books they would recommend, but then finding what is out there up to date. A lot of teachers like their comfort books, the books that they have grown up with and studied and you know, their go-to. And I think it's important to have a bit of a mixture, those nice classics that people love, you know, teachers have to be excited about what they're reading, but also to open the world to the fact that there are new and modern non-fiction that also need to be included within within a teacher's collection within the library. But I think if the teacher was excited about the resources sat there, they would be bringing their students into the library to make sure they engage with them.
It's an interesting point. Daniel, do you think science teachers spend much of their time in the library at your school?
I wouldn't claim to speak for the science department, and I'm sure they do things that are outside my ken, but I'm not sure science teachers spend any time in the library in my school.
I think maths teachers don't spend much time in the library either.
Yes, yeah, so it doesn't necessarily feel like space often. I don't think that's terrible if the resource, the go-to resource for science are resources they're more comfortable with accessing online, then they are the subject expert. They'll know how to resource their curriculum. I was thinking in terms of what you with regards to are not for teachers and teachers being in a little bit about conversation that on one of the I don't know whether other English teachers listening know this, but KCL they provide a day of free on Shakespeare with their Institute of Shakespeare Studies. And things that one of the KCL lecturers there was that secondary school teachers have encyclopedic knowledge of Bradley. That seems to be where Shakespeare criticism starts form classroom. You know, it's a good foundation, but there's an awful lot come since then. And, you know, even in English, there may not be as much up-to-date reading amongst teaching
I would agree. I know that, you know, librarians don't like to talk about it, but we do something that's called weeding, and it's something that teachers really don't like. But I have to say now, and I'm going to say it very quietly, that actually it's important that it's done, because school libraries are, you know, they're not going to get any bigger. So your library is the size that it is. And actually, if we never remove old stock, then you can't find the space for new stock. So your school library is not an archives. Your school library is a current, modern, thriving, up-to-date resource that your students need. So when you have, as a teacher, that treasured go-to resource, it's something that you need to keep within your classroom and show your students, but actually you need to be encouraging them to look at and access the you know, the modern stuff that is available, that is moving things forward in education. So you know, I'm not saying that we need to get rid of everything. There's obviously the classics that we need to keep hold of, and what it's a really in if a teacher was to engage with me about their subject resources, I think what works really well is that conversation about that book that as a librarian I want to get rid of, and as a teacher you want to keep it. And actually that discussion is a really a beneficial thing for both, because it allows the librarian to see and understand what it is that's within that book that is important to you as a teacher, and maybe agree that it needs to be kept, but then help students to engage with it, but also allow the librarian to go, well, now that I know what's in it and what I'm looking for, you know, let me find a list of other resources that you might want to consider as well. And I think, you know, school libraries are not about the librarian finding the right resources all the time. It's about, you know, a full school collaboration in the resources. And you know, it always seems to be that the English department is the people that get the resources in the school library, but it's because the English department seems to like libraries and understand them, whereas the science and the, you know, other departments generally tend to think that it's not for them. And I think that, you know, we need to change that attitude with teachers. You know, the library, school library, is there for everybody, even the maths teacher.
Yeah, we've had a couple more texts in. So Lisa says, who I presume is a scientist, we normally spend our time at the laboratory. So busy involved in Absolutely. In experiments. But I think there's certainly a case for more scientists perhaps spending more time in the school libraries. I mean, in the school I'm in, the science department has its own very swanky building with a full set of very, very up-to-date and modern laboratories and working spaces. So we don't tend to see them in the older part of the college building where our library is based as much as perhaps we could do. Because, as I say, we do have students going through doing EPQs on scientific matters. They do have to use the library to do that project well, because they need to research the existing state of the scientific research, and they need to have some sense of which authorities to go to when designing their hypotheses. So yeah, I'd like to see more scientists in our library.
I can say there's lots of STEM projects, isn't there, going on as well. So, you know, any kind of STEM project that is an inquiry needs to have a library and the skill set that is needed to do it well. You know, our understanding of engineering doesn't just come to us. We need to engage with it as well as practically. We need to be engaged with it as an understanding of how things work and move forward, don't we? So there needs to be a balance. I agree.
And if we think about the point you've made about weeding and the relatively short shelf life, if you'll pardon the pun, of non-fiction texts, is there a real issue there about how budget is spent when it comes to investing in non-fiction texts for our library shelves?
I think there's generally across the board, there's a real problem of budgets for school libraries. I think it's because of the lack of understanding that they're a whole school resource. I think it's seen as the library, and you're buying books for the library rather than the whole school. The finance. Basically, people think that if there's books on shelves, your library is well stocked. You know, what you don't want is a library full of books that are never touched, and you would be better off getting rid of all of your old books and having the, you know, 20 or 30 that are brand new, because they would then get used and looked at. But you know, I've seen this before. This less is more is a case in point where we've gone in and we've done a massive weed, where a library hasn't been touched for years. You know, finding books from the 1950s on the shelves, which student is going to look at that? You know, it's changing the mindset. So, you know, packed shelves of old books is not a school library, and not a good school library, and actually they need a budget spent on them. So I think budgets are a very difficult thing for schools, because they've resourced the library, but it's one of these ongoing. So the standard suggestion is 10% of your stock needs replacing every year, and you should have 10 books per student. So that gives you an idea of the number of books you should have in your library, and 10% of those should be changed every year. It's a big cost, but it's a cost that is of value if it's done well.
It does sound a big cost if I'm thinking of it in the context of where I am at the moment.
Yeah.
Daniel, is your sixth form centre at your school separate from the main building, and does it have its own library?
It is separate from the main. And it has a small library that's entirely non-fiction texts, but there are texts that sixth formers would be better off going to the library for, and use the main library in addition to their much smaller library. We also have a library in our department, which is very specifically, almost exclusively, criticism for the texts that we study, along with the English Matters magazine, EMC magazines, the various one gets as a key coordinator or as a head of department for English department. And again, they're very much tied to the specific curriculum we do at A level in English. literature and English language and literature.
Okay, so your sixth formers have a small library that's separate, but they use the main library as well.
Yes, and they use the departmental.
Super. Your line's still not brilliant, Daniel, but I think we'll persevere for the last 10 minutes. Elizabeth, we've talked about two very, very interesting and powerful topics for our listeners this evening. So I wondered if you wanted to stay for the last 10 minutes and discuss with us what the perfect library might contain, or whether you would prefer to join us another day, perhaps.
Well, I'll happily join you another day, but actually I'm quite happy to stay for another 10 minutes and tell you exactly what I think you should have for a perfect library.
Perfect. I've got my idea of what I think a perfect school library would contain. And I've been thinking about this for probably about 10 years or so as a consequence of moving from a city academy school in South London with a very, very modern and contemporary library space to moving to an independent school which has been around for a while with a very, very traditional, formal, oak-panelled library space. And I'm thinking I'd like to try and combine the best elements of the two. So the things I particularly look for when I go to the library as a reader myself is I look for a really, really comfortable space to read in. Sometimes I want that comfortable space to read in to be within sight of other people, because sometimes I like to feel that I'm in a group, even if I'm studying separately on my own. But on other occasions, I like to seal myself off in my own little cocoon and just focus on the text I'm reading or the piece of work I'm trying to write. So I'd like a really, really nice, comfortable reading space. Perhaps not quite as comfortable a reading space as my six-year-old daughter might like, kind of beanbags and cushions, but something very, very nice to sit on for maybe 2 or 3 hours at a time before I get up and have lunch or walk about. So a nice sitting space has got to be in there somewhere. I think second thing I'm looking for is as much as possible to be on the shelves without having to wait a long time to request something from Stacks. And that comes down to, I suppose, the conversation we've had just now about space, what you decide to keep in and keep out, rather like what we as English teachers have to decide constitutes the canon that we teach. So I'd like as much as possible to be available to me as quickly as possible, because sometimes all I want to do is check a reference or two and then return the book and then move on to something else. And the third thing I would like in the perfect library would be a space where I could do something other than study, a space where I could perhaps socialize in a controlled way so that I wasn't disturbing other users of the library, and perhaps, you know, have a small meal or something, a nice cup of hot chocolate on a cold day like we're having at the moment. Those would be the three things that I would particularly value in a library. The closest I've seen to that so far is the University of York's library, which has most of those three elements. And despite being the kind of contemporary architecture that I find slightly less appealing than the older things, it's a very bright, light space to work in. So those are my three things that I would look for in the perfect library. Daniel, do you want to have a go?
I was thinking in terms of school library, and the perfect library for adult is going to look different from the perfect school library. I do think describing very much sounds like a university libraries, actually. I'm not a particularly good example. One thing I would say that, you know, should go to all libraries is a which adults or children can actually discuss their reading outside of the main sort of independent quiet study and reading area of the main library. I think a sort of if you think to the library at Gold, the large foyer area is a couple of comfortable seating, desks with outlets laptops and just a lot of collaborative work. And I think quite a few universities do that well as well. And I do think that it's a thing from what you'd consider to be essential in most, actually, it would be my ideal for school. And I know that in school libraries, it often goes very wrong and you end up with a center in which there's no real library, basically it's a computer room with books.
Yeah, indeed, that computer room with books tendency is something we probably as English teachers want to try and avoid. Elizabeth, your perfect school library then, you can design it from scratch. What three things would you include in it?
So I think you definitely, you know, you've definitely got me with the comfortable space. There has to be an element of a social space. So that opportunity for students to be able to browse and chat about the books that they're reading. It's about getting that element of balance, isn't it? That you know, just because you're talking about a book doesn't mean to say you have to start talking very loudly. So it's about creating the right mood within this social space. Certainly providing a comfortable study space, a space where students can access the, you know, can plug in their laptops or can you know, spread out, give them the space that they need to grab a book and have a book on their desk as well. So it's about again creating the atmosphere that is, this space is about, you know, you want to come and get on with something and you want to sit down and you want to work and actually you have the right to do that. I think that's something that we miss. I think you're right when we talk about, you know, learning resource centres that are trying to be everything for everybody. And I think you need, you know, so you need to be able to partition it off in some way, which I'm not quite sure how. And I think coffee shops are a difficult one. School libraries, you don't want food or drink in the library because there's just, you know, there's no way you can contain it. So I'm on the fence about that one. I think in an adult library, yes, they can have coffee. I think in a school library, let's keep the food and drink in the canteen.
Perfect. I think we're going to have to bring it to an end because we're nearly out of time. But Elizabeth Hutchinson, thank you very, very much indeed for contributing tonight. It's been absolutely wonderful to hear about your experiences of running libraries, your experiences of thinking about the future of school libraries and hearing about your suggestions for what the perfect library might contain.
Thank you. It's been.
Thank you very much for your time tonight.
It's been a real pleasure. And if anybody wants to contact me or find me, I am on Twitter. Elizabeth Hutch is what it is. And if anybody wants to know more about Fossil, then I'm happy to tell them.
Perfect. Could you give us a web address for Fossil if you have it?
Yes, Fossil. Fossil.org.uk. So it's fossil.org.uk.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. And Daniel, thank you very much for joining us too. We've had a bit of difficulty hearing you at some points this evening, but hopefully we'll get you back on again soon. And we
will... apologise for the terrible connection.
It's the internet. That's what we've all learned from e-learning, isn't it?
Yes.
But it's good to hear from you. We'll get you back on again soon and we will explore these ideas further. So there we go, everybody. That's the end of another show. So thank you again to my guests, Elizabeth Hutchinson and Daniel Bundred. I hope you've enjoyed listening to our show tonight and exploring the role that libraries and librarians play in schools. If you are a teacher and haven't spoken to your librarian yet this term, you know what you're doing tomorrow morning. Thank you very much indeed. This has been The Late Late Show. I've been Christopher Vowles. Thank you and good night.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.